Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we are speaking with Axel Merk, President, Chief Investment Officer, and founder of Merk Funds. Axel is a noted expert on world currencies and manages several mutual funds that manage currency risk for investors, as well as an equity fund and a brand new gold fund that we're going to hear about today. Now, for years, he's been an outspoken critic of U.S. monetary policy, warning investors that the current course risks seriously devaluing the dollar. He's also author of Sustainable Wealth, very readable guide to understanding our macroeconomic environment. Hey, the risks that all investors face today, how they can manage their finances to achieve financial stability. Axel, thanks so much for taking time to join us today.
Great to be with you. It's an honor.
So let's jump right into it. These markets today, we can measure just how dead they are, even as the equity markets hit new highs by declining viewership in cable business shows, really low trading volume, and market volatility that seems to be all but non-existent. Is any of this concerning to you?
Very much so. I think complacency is the mother of all bubbles. And let me explain that a little bit. When you have complacency, which in the markets you can measure, amongst others, in volatility. So when volatility is low, but as the prices are rising, then investors are lured into an investment not fully aware of what the risks, the dormant risks are, what they are when they pop back up. And we see that over and over again. It was in the tech bubble in the 90s, in the housing bubble, emerging market local debt funds. Everybody stormed into them, thought they'd get a free lunch. And obviously, all these things have a bad ending. And now we see in the equity markets, prices going ever higher. At the same time, volatility, the VIX index, for example, is going lower and lower. And to us, that means that if the tide turns, if for whatever reason the risk comes back to the market, investors are going to be out in a heartbeat because they'll suddenly realize, oh, this wasn't risk-free. I guess I could lose money. And that's when you can set yourself up for really sharp declines. And part of the reason is because obviously people take a leverage, they gear themselves up, and then they have to scramble to liquidate the collateral. And that's how you then have this contagion or whatever you want to call it. But that's how you can get a real market crash.
Well, this complacency breeds all kinds of things. Certainly one of the things I didn't mention, which is sitting out there, is margin debt on the NYSE. It's at new records as far as I can tell. So people have really decided to go long and go longer, and every day I see the markets rise. There's some pretty interesting macroeconomic developments out there, whether we're in Eastern Europe or in the Middle East. None of those really seem to be playing into the markets in ways that I recognize. You know, 10 years ago, what's happening in Iraq would have fed into the oil markets in a very detectable way. I really can't see the footprints of that, except for one day last week. What are you seeing there?
Well, I can only tell you what's driving this. What's driving it is monetary policy. One of the main goals of monetary policy has been to use a technical term here, to reduce risk premia, to make it less expensive for risky borrowers to borrow money. We see that everywhere, and the most in the media we hear about how Spain now pays the same as the U.S. on the longer term debt, but risky borrowers don't pay much more than the creditworthy borrowers. And so the reduction in this risk premia is what reduces the volatility, and of course that spills over to other assets. We see that in the equity markets, we see that everywhere in the currency markets, our field, volatility is compressed as well. And Janet Yellen was asked about this just a few days ago. And she pretty much said, oh, she's not concerned about complacency in the market. So she's complacent about complacency. To me, that's about as significant as Greenspan suggesting home prices can never go down and Bernanke suggesting subprime is contained. It's a major, major problem. And obviously, as you point out, there are plenty of challenges in the world. Usually what tips a market over, though, isn't the most obvious thing, because that's quote-unquote priced in. It can come out of the blue. Anything can tip this market over. Suddenly, one day, people wake up and the glass is half empty, and everybody runs for the hills.
Well, so let's talk about that for a second. What can an investor do to protect their wealth if they are concerned about this complacency? What would they do?
Well, the first thing is if everything in your portfolio has been going up, you should be concerned. If you're not concerned, you're not paying attention. You should be glad if something hasn't been moving up, because then when the tide turns, you have a chance at least that whatever that is, this might help you to buffer the downturn. Now, one of the basic rules of thumbs is obviously if you have an equity portion in your portfolio, odds are that has gone up because equity markets have outperformed a lot of other things. And so rebalance. Now, to the extent that you are in equities, consider using something that uses some hedging. There are all kinds of strategies out there where you can buffer yourself on the downside. Now, ideally, you may want to get out of equities entirely, but obviously that's not particularly diversified, and I can't give specific investment advice here. Personally, I have a lot of my equity exposure hedged, and then I have diversified. I particularly like currencies because in the currency market, you can design a portfolio that has a low correlation to the equity markets. The problem is that most folks rebalance between equity and bonds. Well, the bond market isn't exactly one where at least I have a particularly positive outlook on, and so it makes it difficult. The Fed has inflated all asset prices, so hiding is very, very difficult, and that's why one has to look at alternatives, one has to look at hedging techniques. Precious metals, obviously, is one area one can look at. Gold has historically done well when the stock market has come down more severely, but all of these are trade-offs. It's not like gold is safe if your daily living expenses are in U.S. dollars. And so these are all trade-offs, and in this quote-unquote risk-free environment, I think risks are particularly high.
Okay, I want to talk about both bonds and currencies. Bonds first. You know, in the past, bonds provided a nice, actually negative correlation to equities, but I want to talk to you about that because we live in a world where Spanish debt today is trading at 2.65% on the 10-year. France is at 1.76, Italy at 2.88, all of these compared to the U.S. at 2.61. These seem more than adequately bid at the moment, and so if I heard you right, you think it might not be reasonable to expect that these yields should go lower if equities drop.
Well, no, I don't think so. Having said that, I'm far more comfortable with Spanish bonds now than they were before, not because I would ever buy them, but because it is speculators buying them. It used to be that financial institutions bought those bonds, and they thought they were risk-free. They clearly were not. That's why you had this contagion in the Eurozone. Now you have yield chasers go after these things. It's the money that went out of emerging markets didn't go back to the U.S. The U.S. dollar is no longer the safe haven of choice. It was Portugal, because Mr. Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, promises to do whatever it takes. So why not capture some additional yield? I'm not suggesting you should do that, but the positive of that, if you want to see the glass half full, is it's speculative money. Who cares if speculators lose money? It is a problem if banks lose money, not because I pity with the banks, but because our financial system comes crashing down if they lose too much money. And so it is hedge funds buying Greek banks, for example, rather than having the capital of Northern European banks be exposed to the banking system in Greece. And so from that point of view, it's healthier. Now, what is not healthy, of course, is that people are not being, don't have to pay the amount that they should be paying, given how reckless some of these finances are run in some of these countries. And so we are re-enabling some of the bad behavior that got us into trouble in the first place. But of course, that's a story for another day and a problem for another day. And for the time being, these countries want to live happily ever after.
No one sheds a tear for the speculators. I see. Well, that's an interesting way to look at it. And I see everything out there as more speculation than pure investment at this point in time. And that makes a certain amount of sense until, as you say, the tide turns. So talking about tides turning, currencies, your area of unique expertise, I think, is your depth is really centered there. There's been a lot of chatter lately coming out of Russia primarily, but China and a number of other nations calling for a move away from the dollar. Is this just chatter? Is it actually really happening? Or is this just something we just keep our eye on in case in the future it becomes real?
Well, if you keep an eye on it, you just might not notice it happening. I mean, that's what it's been happening in front of our eyes over years. Think about a frog in a boiling pot. Mm-hmm. People are going to say, oh, the dollar loses reserve currency status, and if that and when that happens, I'll get out of the dollar. Well, I just mentioned earlier that a year ago, when the Fed a taper talk started and money fled emerging markets, it did not go to the dollar, it went to the euro. And so similarly, if you look at when there's a quote-unquote risk off day, the dollar has more often than not in recent months been going down rather than up. So this so-called flight to quality hasn't happened to the U.S. Now, you can argue maybe this crisis hasn't, and we haven't had a severe enough of a crisis, but when the Ukraine crisis first was announced, for about a few hours, the euro went down. Ever since then, the euro has been going up. If you think about it, if you're Russian, where are you going to put your money? You're not going to put it in the U.S. You're going to put it either into London real estate or you're going to put it into the euro. And so the world is changing, and it doesn't mean that if we have a big crisis, the dollar won't benefit, but it has been changing. People like the dollar because of liquidity, not because of quality. But if the U.S. starts to introduce capital controls, such as on Russians, well, why use the dollar if you can use something else? And that's why gradually the dollar is losing its reserve currency status.
And so as you watch that process happening, is this something you think it's like how Hemingway described how a man goes broke, slowly then all at once? Do you think this is the frog boils for a while and then all of a sudden it you know, goes worse? Or is this just something you think we're just going to see a steady sort of a repositioning away from the dollar on a percentage basis in terms of reserve assets and that is more of the same?
Well, when I look investing, I do probability analysis. I assign certain scenarios and give certain risks to them. Now, the more likely scenarios is going to be slow and gradual, but there is certainly a risk out there that it's more abrupt. In fact, if you look at the minutes of the European Central Bank, every month since the inception until just about Mario Draghi took over, they had a warning that there might be a disorderly adjustment of global imbalances. That's a code word for a dollar crash. They took that out then at some point. But that is something that's certainly on the minds of policymakers the world all over. But at the same time, of course, if the Chinese, they own the debt market in the U.S., and so they can't just dump it. Some people say, oh, if they don't like the U.S., then they'll just dump it. Well, they're shooting themselves in the foot when they do that. And so usually these policymakers try to do it slow, gradually, prudently. By the way, one of the reasons why I got into this business in the current form in the first place is because back in 2003, the then head of the European Central Bank said, we hope and pray the global adjustment process will be slow and gradual. My response to that was, when central bankers revert to hopes and prayers, I got to act.
Well, let's talk about the central bankers, because as you've mentioned several times already, and which everybody listening to this already knows, central bankers are really driving the bus. They're doing it with their liquidity injections. They're doing it by picking winners and losers, respectively, in how they put their money out there. They have a very, very large impact on the market. So you're senior economic advisor at Merck Funds is William Poole, the former president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis and FOMC member. So obviously he's got some insights. What can you share with us about his views of recent and potential future Federal Reserve actions?
Well, obviously, he is not an active participant, but he has very strong views. He is very much more in the hawkish camp of the FOMC. But I had this discussion with him specifically about these compressed risk premia, and we were discussing whether it is possible for the Fed to engineer an orderly exit. And I'm not talking about here the raising interest rates or tapering per se, but an exit from these low risk premia. And we just cannot imagine how that's going to be done easily. And so nothing has ever worked, and that's my interpretation, the way that the Fed has wanted it to work. And so why should this work any better? Now, Bill Poole is very critical of many of the policies, and one of the things he's very critical of is that if we're going to start paying interest on reserves to somehow raise rates, that's going to be a political nightmare, because de facto we're going to be paying billions, if not over $100 billion, to banks to entice them not to lend. They currently park all this money at the Fed. If the economy gets going, they would want to spend more. They could, but then the Fed is going to hold them back, not by selling securities, but by paying the banks, pretty much telling them, oh, you can't lend because we're going to pay you so much interest by keeping the money here. And so that's going to be a nightmare. Then the Fed is going to use administrative tools to try to prevent the banks from lending. Most notably, they can talk about things like capital adequacy ratios. Well, if you're J.P. Morgan, you can easily raise money in the markets. So those are the discussions, the sort of discussions we have with Bill Poole, the sort of challenges that are going to be ahead. One of the things that Bill Poole is very critical of is that there's no clarity on what the Fed is going to do. The Fed is conducting policies ad hoc, and Janet Yellen clearly says she does not pursue a rule-based policy right now. Well, how can you price risk if you don't know where the Federal Reserve is going? And so a lot of the uncertainty in the market is due to the very policies that the Fed is pursuing. This stage, the markets are quiet, but this is not a very good omen as we're going to get into rougher waters down the road.
Well, Axel, it's very interesting. One of the things you mentioned in there, I'd like to get some more clarity on, which you mentioned that the Federal Reserve would probably not sell securities in its efforts to reel in additional bank lending that might come when the economy recovers, or if it does. Why wouldn't they do that as compared to raising interest rates on reserves? What would happen if they sold those securities back into the market?
Sure, raising lots of topics here at once. Basically, the Fed has bought all these assets by creating money out of thin air. Now it's stuck with these. If they were to sell them, obviously it's much easier to buy securities than to sell them. Mm-hmm. Odds are prices would plunge. And more importantly, they would sell them at a loss. That's quite expected by everybody, including mm-hmm. the Fed. Now, because the capital base, the net equity of the Fed is very, very small, odds are that the losses would wipe out the equity at the Fed. Now, fear not, a central bank is not like your legal corporation. Right. The Bank of Israel, for example, has had a negative net worth for over 20 years, but it doesn't look good. And so the Fed rather not sell those securities. Instead, they pay interest on reserves. No, I don't think actually they'll do that either because of the conflict with Congress. There's another tool that they have. It's called reverse repos. Now, I'm not going to explain this now in detail, but it's effectively the same thing as paying interest on reserve with a key difference that Congress is not going to get it for a year or so, and so any backlash from Congress is going to take a little longer to come, but that problem is going to come nonetheless.
Interesting. Okay, I'm going to look into that, and obviously we don't have the time to really go into reverse repos at this point, but thank you for that. Now, I really want to talk about gold for a minute. We've hopefully maybe hit bottom on gold prices. Who knows? We've had a little bit of a resurgence, but you have an exciting new product that Merck Funds is offering, the Merck Gold Trust, trading under the ticker symbol OUNZ. Tell us about what it was like to ring the opening bell on the NYSE floor at the launch of OUNZ, and then tell us about the fund.
Oh, sure. It was in May we had the honor of ringing the opening bell on New York Stock Exchange for OUNZ, OUNZ, as you point out. What was really special about is were the other folks that joined us. Mm-hmm. It was a ceremony. It's obviously on the one thing, it's a nice marketing event, but it was really, we had a lot of influencers from the gold community come together, and that made that day really special. Now, OUNZ, what it is, it's a deliverable gold ETF, and what we mean with that is just like other ETFs out there, you can buy gold now through the New York Stock Exchange with the key difference that investors can take delivery of the gold. And not only can they take delivery of the London bars that we hold, but at the time investors take delivery, they can opt to have it exchanged into other coins. Because we don't think most investors really like to have a London bar, that these are these big clunky things you see in James Bond movies, but they'd rather have a maple leaf or an American gold eagle. And so we give them that option. Now we don't think everybody's going to now buy their gold on the exchange for physical delivery, but we do think people like that option. And one of the key things is that taking delivery of what you already own through the shares is not a taxable event. And so assume you're buying these shares now, and a couple of years down the road, gold has appreciated, and now you suddenly want the coin in your pocket. Well, with our product, you don't have to sell it, have a taxable event, and then buy the coin. Instead, you can call us up and say, hey, I'd like to get my gold delivered, and we can do a tax-free exchange into coins and send them to your home.
Wow, that's really handy sounding. And so some details then. Where is the gold going to be housed, and what kind of trading volumes are you expecting here?
Yes, so we hold the gold in London, and the trading volume, it's and now as we talk today is a nice day in the market. We trade over 120,000 shares, and the share price is priced at 1/100th of the price of gold. So as we talk, it's at $13.18. The key thing here is that this is a gold ETF. And in order to this, which one of the objectives, the secondary objective, is to track the price of gold. The primary objective is obviously to hold the gold and to be able to take delivery, but the secondary objective is to track the price of gold. And the nice thing about this is that the market makers that help to keep the price near the underlying value of the gold, they hedge the entire gold exposure. So for them, it is no extra work, or not significant extra work, to work with the Merck Gold Trust versus the other gold ETFs. And so we've historically, or since inception, had about a 1 cent spread in the market, a fabulous spread. We can take large orders, and so it has not been a problem for anybody to place large orders. And at this stage of of course, the interest in gold hasn't been all that exciting in recent weeks. And with that, we are already able to get a decent volume. We have about $50 million in the trust at this stage, and we're looking forward to getting much, much more down the road.
Well, fantastic. And so when somebody would describe the actual process of taking delivery, you made it sound very simple. Somebody calls somebody up and says they'd like delivery, and it happens. Is it that simple?
Well, almost. We do have a website, merckgold.com, mm-hmm. where we go through the process. But the short of it is that on our website, we have a calculator. You plug in how many shares you have. We tell you how much gold it corresponds to. And it guides you through the process of what you have to specify, the type of gold you want to have, give you your account details and so forth. And you can submit that to us for evaluation. You do have to pay a fee for that process because obviously a coin usually sells at a premium versus the spot price. Mm-hmm. But what you do is you talk to us and you agree on the type of gold you want to have. You agree on the delivery location. Coins, as I indicated, we can deliver to someone's home address. We can deliver anywhere in the world, by the way. If somebody wants to have it delivered abroad, you can request that. London bars, we have to deliver with an armored truck. Those can't be delivered to residences. So there's going to be a little bit back and forth to agree on the location and the type of gold. And then you pay your fees up front. We give you a window which you can deliver the shares. You basically do a regular share transfer to the trustee. The trustee is Bank of New York. And then the shares are accepted, they're retired, and then we initiate the delivery. The entire process for coins to be delivered takes a good week or so. And you can initiate at any time. Now, if you have a more exotic request, that can obviously take longer.
Excellent. I appreciate that. And is this only in 1 ounce increments, or are you doing fractionals too?
No, 1 ounce is the minimum, and also in 1 ounce increments. And by the way, we specifically made 1 ounce the minimum investment. Having said that, it is not really economical because we have some minimum fees that are associated with it.
Yep.
If you have something like 40 ounces delivered, a 10 ounce Australian bar, for example, you pay about the same as you would pay through other sources of being able to buy those 10-ounce bars, for example. If you get much less than that, then the minimum fees are going to make it more expensive than to go to your local dealer. But the point here is that we really want to encourage people to take delivery to test the process. In fact, we were awarded a patent on this process. We believe our process is highly scalable. If there was ever a rush to take delivery, we think we can make it happen with our process, and so that's really different from these other products that are out there. You have an ETF, it tracks the spot price of gold, you can take delivery. Taking delivery is not a taxable event. Our view is, why would you buy any of the other gold ETFs when this one is available? And we charge 40 basis points a year, which is the same as for the leading gold ETF out there.
Oh, that's fantastic. That is a huge distinction between the one that's out there. I get questions about some of the other gold ETFs all the time. I've not been a fan of them for a variety of reasons, but this delivery takes away one of the biggest reasons that I've not been a fan of them, for starters, and that's just fantastic. So gold has been, if I could just get your views very quickly. Now, it obviously takes a long time to set something like this up. Congratulations on getting it done. It's out there. How do you feel about gold in this current environment?
Well, the reason why we like gold in the medium to long term is because I don't think we can afford positive real interest rates, meaning interest rates net of inflation, not in the U.S., not in the Eurozone, not in Japan. Mario Draghi, the head of the ECB, has said as much. He said real interest rates are negative. They'll be more negative over time. If you think about it, what happens if the Japanese succeed with their policies, if they get economic growth?
Right.
Bond prices are going to fall. How can they afford to finance the deficit? I don't think they can. So there's going to be a bias towards lower rates in Japan, as far as the eye can see. In the U.S., we have same problems. If we don't tackle entitlement reform, and I don't think the political constellation is such that we will kick the can down the road, which means if indeed we get economic growth, real economic growth, yes, the Fed can talk tough, but how on earth are we going to impose positive real interest rates if indeed we do have inflation up in the numbers that the Fed really cares about? We cannot finance our government debt 10 years down the road if we have to go back to the historic levels that we've been paying to service our debt. Now, fear not, the economists don't think we'll ever get there. But I actually agree, it may not happen, but the reason it will not happen is because the Federal Reserve is going to have a bias towards low rates, and even if they normally move higher on a real basis, that would be negative. And with that, I think the price of gold should do quite well over the next 5 to 10 years.
Very interesting. Yeah, negative real interest rates obviously is one big lever for gold prices. Also, it correlates reasonably well with excess government spending. I think governments are tied to levels of deficit spending that I don't know how they get out of. Just like you say, the Federal Reserve is trapped. When I look at debt to GDP across literally every major industrialized country from 2007 to today, on just the debt to GDP ratio, they're all higher. So I don't know how they get around that either.
Yes, yeah, so debt to GDP, I agree with you in principle. Having said that, it's very difficult to forecast really anything with just a nominal ratio. But if you extrapolate out just how much we'll be paying to service our interest expenses, we currently pay around $200 billion a year. If you use the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, projections 10 years out, they think we will be spending about $900 billion a year. Now, that assumes we're not going back to the historic average that we have been paying on our debt. If we go back to the historic average, it's going to be about $1.2 trillion a year just to service the debt on our interest. Now, some people say, oh, the CBO projections are always wrong, and how can you rely on that? Well, they might be wrong, but it's about the risk. There is, of course, the quote-unquote risk opportunity that we'll get a grand bargain and we'll fix all our major entitlement obligations and so forth. But for that to happen, we actually have to go a lot in the direction of some of what you're probably suggesting. We need to have a carbon tax. We need to have a value-added tax, all those sort of things to generate sufficient revenue to be able to afford those sort of things. I just don't see the political reality right now that's going to get us there. If we have a printing press called the Federal Reserve that's going to keep rates low.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. Well, with that, we're out of time. I really appreciate your time today. I'm very interested in directing people towards your excellent work, investment opportunities, and ways of following your thinking. How would they do that?
Sure. We have a free newsletter at MerckInvestments.com, and so we have free websites, but you can browse through them from one to the other, Merck Gold, Merck Funds, and MerckInvestments.com. Look at our gold product, look at our mutual funds, and obviously sign up for insights. Follow me on Twitter, any of that, or keep listening to your program, as I hope I'll talk to you again, because this has been a great pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for that. And for everybody listening, that's Merck, M-E-R-K. We've got some links at the bottom of this podcast so that you can just click away. And I do hope you read some of the excellent macro investment advice that exists over there at Merck. They're really very, very, very well done. So, with that, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure, Axel.
My pleasure.